Well, with
Cool.
me today is our first time guest on ANC Report, Tom Hayes. He's a film director. I remember watching his films back when I was in college. He made People and the Land, also Native Son, which is for free online. It's a 57-minute documentary on Palestine. He's done work in Cambodia and most recently the film Two Blue Lines, which the trailer was shown and part of some clips were shown at the event in Washington this year at the TILAP conference, the Israeli Influence in American Policy. That's where I met Tom, and now we are having this interview today. Tom, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
It's good to see you, Brian. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you've made several films about Palestine, yet you are not Palestinian and you're not Jewish either. What's your motivation for this?
Well, it was kind of a roundabout thing. I didn't come to it because of any real personal connection with the issues. I had done a film called Refugee Road about the Southeast, the Cambodian refugees, and I just sort of one day I put two and two together. I had read a little story in the paper about how Israel had launched an airstrike against a guerrilla stronghold in southern Lebanon. And one of the stories that I read said that this guerrilla stronghold was called Rashidiya. And I just happened to have over my dining room table a map of all the refugee camps in the world that someone from Church World Services had given me. And when I realized that Israel had bombed a refugee camp and that the US press was just whitewashing it with the term guerrilla stronghold, that really just, it was like being struck by lightning, because like any American, I knew Israel. Like we all know Israel good, and so I was disturbed that this thing that called Israel, that I had this very positive impression of, had done such a heinous thing, but also that the US press at the same time was handling it with such kid gloves, that really sparked my interest, and I started researching, and that was in 1981. So this really became a focus of my life, that once I did my first film, Native Sons, Palestinians in Exile, and the repercussions of that on my life, I realized that this wasn't a Jewish or Palestinian issue. This was a world issue, and a particularly an American issue.
Yes, well, it's definitely cost America enough blood and money being involved in these conflicts and fostering different sides all over the Middle East, not just between Palestine and Israel. So your new film, Two Blue Lines, that took 25 years to make.
Yes, well, and it's kind of an odd story, because my mission was to document the human and political rights situation, or lack thereof, of Palestinian people. And so I go back time after time after time, and the thing is that the Israel destruction forces have very little enthusiasm for people documenting them at play. And consequently, I was being braced all the time. I'd either have a closed military area order put on me, or they would curfew the town, or they would just try to seize our equipment or our film, or physically assault the crew. And so consequently, I would either go up the, because I had to come up with a plan B. I had a film crew on my hands. So I either have to go up the hills and try to find something to do up there, like try to find some settler that would let me shoot film. You say film when you're in the Middle East. And
Yeah, of course.
or I'd go back across the Green Line and try to find some interesting Israeli to speak to, someone who wasn't sort of this craven Zionist. And over the years, after trip after trip of this happening, that footage just began to accumulate in my editing room. And I realized at one point that these interesting Israelis were really telling the truth about, they were in the best sense of the Jewish tradition, empathic, compassionate, really rooted in other human beings, their narrative of what Israel was doing to
They seem to be a
Palestinians.
lot more aware than Americans and the American diaspora as well. Everybody in Israel seems to be aware of it, and either they are just ardent racist and don't care, but are still aware, Or they are sympathetic and they know it's screwed up, but they didn't feel powerless to do anything. But they're not really doing this out of ignorance. It's either intentional and it's based on, religious dogma where they think God is a real estate agent, or racism, or both, or they oppose it. Whereas in America, I don't think a lot of people even know Palestine was a place. It just seems like it's been Israel since biblical times. That's the sort of narrative you get from the ignorance from the US.
It's a really a magnificent edifice of fraud, the whole conflation of this colonialist 19th century colonialist regime with the Jewish tradition. I mean, it's been very successful, and I think you're absolutely right that in Israel, there is a much more vibrant discourse, social discourse about this, and there are lots of Israelis who are not racists, and they are not people who condone ethnic cleansing, and they're active. In fact, almost everybody in Two Blue Lines, almost every Israeli in that film has been in jail at one point or another because of their resistance to the regime. And I think, my previous two films on this topic, I really, really worked to build conduits for Palestinian voices to try to get those voices into the ears of Americans. And that really wasn't all that successful. Americans are so well programmed to diss Arabs in general and Palestinians in particular, where I think that building conduits for these Jewish Israeli voices is important too, because they are also a suppressed voice from the Middle East, and I think that they're terribly important. They show us the path forward.
They probably face, even though someone went or all of them went to jail at some point, that's still less consequences than Palestinians who would, if they figure out who they were, that would cooperate with you, would probably face something worse.
So many people that have worked with me or let me even film them have suffered terrible consequences. And the thing is that it used to be, back during the first uprising, really up to the second one, that if a Palestinian went on camera, they could pretty well expect to take a beating and be sent to jail, administrative detention, without charges or trial. But once the it became institutionalized, the murder, preemptive murder of Palestinians, it's such a polite term, extrajudicial execution. But they're just, the Israeli Defense Forces, that's what they call themselves, they murder
Yeah,
Palestinians without.
defense. Israel recently said they threatened, this is before Trump sent his cruise missiles in, they threatened the exact same air base, saying that if the air defenses attack them again, they would destroy the air base. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, the air bases aren't attacking you. You're attacking Syria, their air defense. You're the bombers. Even when they, I mean, if bombing something's not offense, what's offense? That's the kind of mindset you get and
I
work
mean,
with.
I like calling them the IDF, but I think it's really the Israel Destruction Forces, or maybe it should be the IIF, the Israel Incitement Forces, because there is no better recruiter for violence against Israelis than its own armed forces. That the despicable behavior of those armed forces against the civilian, systematically disarmed civilian population is absolutely off the charts. I mean, this is going to live in history. Right. Well, the thing is, every male in, and really everybody except for the really true, fervently observant Jewish people in Israel has to be in the armed forces. One of the people in Two Blue Lines is an author named Stephen Langfor, and he went to jail because he just refused to participate in the occupation. And he's an Amer he's an American immigrant person, but he's been subsequently very active in Yesh Gavul, the organization that is about there is a limit, there is a boundary. To help people who do refuse to participate in those war crimes.
Have you ever met so much resistance to make a film? I mean, you've been working with the subject of refugees, but I'm going to guess that talking about refugees on the Thai border for Cambodia is not, most people would support that, or at least pretend to, but not resist it, because come on. But with this, it's like God gave us that land, that's mine, and everything is justified for the colonial side.
When I did my first film on Palestine, my home was attacked repeatedly. We had our windows knocked out. We were getting crank calls at all hours of the day and night, threatening to murder me and my wife. When I finally went to the police about it, and the police started tracking down the people that were doing it, then our phone lines were cut. So, okay, if you don't want to get crank calls, then you can't talk to anybody. And there was also organized attempts to get my funding pulled, so I couldn't even finish that film. The night that it premiered, the theater had to be cleared because of a bomb threat. Well, when I did a film about Cambodian refugees, nobody attacked my home or threatened to murder my wife or cut my phone lines or tried to get my funding taken away or force the theater to be cleared for a bomb threat. So you're right when you say that like anything is justified, because this whole thing that like Israel protects the Jews. So if you examine the policies of this regime, then therefore you are attacking the Jews. And it's a really dangerous conflation.
That's one of
And
the
then
saddest weapons, is it's projection, because you've got a racial apartheid state accusing other people of anti-Semitism or racism when they are the ones that are supporting home demolitions, racial segregation, worse than racial segregation in the like black and white segregation in the 50s. And they call you racist when they are supporting the very same, I mean, actual anti-Semitism, actual prejudice toward other Semitic people. And it's completely backwards. And yet, in the US media, they go right along with it. I mean, everybody gets accused of being anti-Semitic. You have to prove you're not a racist first before you can even talk about the issues.
Right, and so it's really easy to intimidate people, and faculty lose their tenure. I mean, journalists are thrown off the air if they don't walk, if they don't stick to the party line about this, and it's dangerous for America. I mean, it's not just the sort of the abrogation of the First Amendment, which I really think is the essence of the Israel lobby's program against Americans, is to abrogate the First Amendment so we can't talk about it. But I think it's also because of the continuation of these really inhuman policies or support for them, it puts every American in danger.
I agree with you about that with the First Amendment. In fact, a lot of the hate crime laws, well, any crime is bad. Hate crime, I assume, would be every crime, but it's specifically to, they want to say that criticism of Israel is a hate crime because they want to say Israel's a Jewish state, so if you're criticizing Israel, you're criticizing the Jews. When really considering Israel a Jewish state is what's racist, and they want to charge hate crimes on people just for saying they're against racial apartheid.
Israel is about as Jewish as a burning cross at a lynching is Christian. That it's just it's a magnificent fraud. I mean, I don't mean that in a positive sense, but still, I mean, it's the grandeur of the fraud is magnificent. It's amazing thing that people who consider themselves, I've got this term PEPs, progressive on everything except Palestine, and you see that across the United States, that people be they'll be for gay rights, women's having sovereignty over their bodies, ends to segregation, stopping police violence against racially based, they'll be cool on every topic imaginable, the great spectrum, rainbow of social issues, and then you
Because they're
get
all socially acceptable. The only one with risk is the one that they won't do.
They won't even let it entertain the thought that the word Palestinian actually points to a human being.
Virtue signaling is fun when there's no skin in the game, when you just get a pat in the back for it. I mean, if you're going to work, you know, and be against some Latin American dictator or something like that, nobody's going to oppose that. But if you're talking about Palestinians, then you have risk. So PAPS, I like that term. It's beyond chutzpah, like Norman Finkelstein might have said. So what I'd like to do, instead of playing inside baseball, I learned something, and I've been deep into this Palestinian issue for a long time. I watched your film. I did not know about Hunin, that a village was dismantled stone by stone and they built a museum out of it. I mean, there are some facts in this film that you know, long-term researchers will find surprising. But I want to go over some of the basic things that you're on the fence, everyday American, Canadian, whoever, just probably doesn't know. Like, how did this conflict begin? They try to make it complicated. It's not 3,000 years old. It started in the 40s. Who took land from who? Who was there? If you want to go over the basics, I think that's going to be helpful.
Well, Zionists, people who support this apartheid, love to use the word complicated. And I love the word complicated because it's an adjective and a verb. You know, it can be used to describe something that is densely complex. Or a past perfect, it's very simple, and I think that if you really want to understand the Indians, then you need to look at what happened to the indigenous people of North America. Mm-hmm. That Europeans came in. Now it really started. This guy Theodore Herzl wrote a book in 1897 called "The Jews' State," Judenstaat. And they had this idea that basically, if we just start acting like Europeans, everything will be cool for us. That if we, you know, take on ethno-nationalism, then that's somehow going to make Jews safe in the world. And after World War II, you know, so that there had been some small colonies there during World War II when Jewish people really needed a safe place to be. The United States refused them entry. England, Great Britain refused them entry, and a lot of people wound up going to Palestine. The British supported that. They had, through the Balfour Declaration, had said that they supported the establishment of a national home for Jewish people in Palestine, which is the most absurd thing you can imagine. That's like me supporting a national home for hippies in the North Pole. I don't own the North Pole, and I don't have any right to dispose of that territory to anybody else. And that's essentially the sort of the imperial background, is that the British set it up.
I'm going to create a Kurdish homeland in Ireland. That's not mine, Ireland. But
exactly, or a Somali homeland in Columbus, Ohio. You know, it's ridiculous. And then in 48, the thing is, it's important to understand that Jewish people lived in Palestine along with Christians and Muslims and Baha'i. A lot of Palestinian people who are Muslim now were Jewish before Salah ad-Din. Their families were Jewish before Salah ad-Din showed up. And there are Christians over there who were Jewish before the Romans decided that Christianity was good. So there's no through line.
There's always been a Jewish minority in the land. But the Zionist kind of biblical mindset, in their minds, they feel like it was purely Jewish. They got exiled, and now they're returning. But the Canaanites and Philistines and all the other people they mention in the Bible were already there and have always been the majority. Not that you can racially inherit land anyway, but if you're going to go that route, it still doesn't work because there was never a land like that. Even King David's empire was just a little fiefdom in Hebron historically, not religiously, but in the real world.
Well, when even if you sort of buy the Old Testament as a history book, which is quite a stretch.
Well, it has talking donkeys and people with magic hair, so I'm going to hold.
Right. Well, when Joshua blew that horn to bring down the walls, well, someone had built those walls that he was blowing the horn to bring down. There was a pre-existing community there before the Hebrew tribes.
Samson killed 1,000 Philistines with a jawbone of a donkey.
Right. Well, yeah, and you know, and Jonah came home one night, and his wife said, "Jonah, where you been?" And he said, "Well, I was swallowed by a whale." But but back into sort of our era, the 40s, it became really clear that these immigrants, Jewish immigrants really wanted to take over the land, and this scared the natives, and they began to resist. And with the help of the British, immigrants were able to arm themselves and eventually drove out more than 700,000 people.
And the British disarmed Palestinians at the same time, so their guns were gone. And then the Irgun and Stern gangs, two Jewish terrorist gangs, were trying to take the entire land at the same time where regular migrants were coming to flee what was happening in Europe. But the Palestinians didn't do any of it.
No, they were. When the British were there, because they left in 47, when the British were there, they would level a house if they found a bullet in it, a Palestinian home. So that there was a real systematic disarming of the indigenous people at the same time that that the Jewish immigrants had arms factories under their schools in Tel Aviv. So, the British tend to treat Europeans better than they do people of color around this planet, and this is just another example of that. And then and the real horror of it, you know, people get displaced. That's what happens in war. People take their children and go someplace where their children aren't going to die. The real sin, the founding sin of the state of Israel, is that it refused to allow the people to return to their homes and properties, and then proceeded to bulldoze their villages. And now, if you go to you go south of Tel Aviv, and you'll see all these orange groves. Well, those orange groves are planted in the rubble of Palestinian villages. Or you go to some of the parks, and you see all these pine trees, which aren't really native. They were planted by the Jewish National Fund, and those are also basically hiding the remains of Palestinian villages.
It's also why Israel has so many giant forest fires, because they took trees that are not indigenous, stuck them there in the Middle East, and then they burn, and they can't put out the fire, and they can't figure out why it does that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, those trees weren't meant to be there, and they get dry, and they're just waiting to go up in smoke. But the thing is that, you know, people talk about one state, two state, and, you know, it's a general international consensus that two states is a good idea for this, you know, to create this Bantustan of 28% of Palestine for all the Palestinians in the world. But really, neither one of those prescriptions is going to really affect the conflict unless the refugees are allowed their right of return. It's not a privilege of return. It's their right as human beings to live in the land of their forebears that they were driven out of by force.
And any other conflict, once the war is over, the people who fled return, except Palestine. And in Palestine, you're talking about of the 800,000, 850,000, over 700,000 were forced out as refugees and could not come back. And the last attorney general we had to even bring that issue up was Robert Kennedy, and someone shot him, allegedly a Palestinian.
No, it's just an inhuman policy. And it also flies in the face of history. I mean, if we're going to buy the idea that that Jews yearned for 2,000 years to return to Palestine. Well, we're only 70 years in on the Palestinian exile, so we can look forward to another 1930 years of Palestinians trying to get home, because there's nothing, no difference between a Palestinian human being and a Jewish human being. And so the whole argument is just so absurd on its face.
During that 2,000-year period, they could go to Palestine and live, because there were Jews living there the whole time. It's not like Nebuchadnezzar is still alive.
Except during the Babylonian era, this whole idea of exile is a myth. It never happened. The Talmud was written in Palestine. It wasn't written in exile somewhere. It wasn't written in Spain. It was that there are ruins of synagogues that cross history since before the Roman era. That there never was a real exile. But you know, it's like, I don't really care about that. What I care about is human equality. And I think that that's where this debate on Palestine really needs to go. It's not about, okay, so all those, these terrible things have happened in the past between the immigrant Israeli community and the indigenous people. Well, now it's time to move forward, and the road forward is equality, that Israel become the state of all the people that it governs. And right now, what calls itself the Jewish state actually governs the lives of more Palestinians than it does Jewish people. Those are just the population facts. Because they still control the lives of everyone in Gaza, they refuse to allow them to return to their homes. They control the lives of every Palestinian in the West Bank, and ultimately they control the lives of the entire Palestinian diaspora, which runs into millions of human beings. So Israel is in fact the government of the Palestinians. I mean, in fact, and consequently, I think that Israel needs to be the state of the people it governs.
When they always will point to a terrorist attack as justification for everything they do, and those things do happen. There used to be suicide bombings. Nowadays, a rocket might land in an empty field or something, and then that justifies everything else. And they'll talk about it, you know, the time between these incidents, between different terrorist attacks, as a relative peace, ignoring the daily abuse that Palestinians have to go through. Their water is taken away, the checkpoints, which are really roadblocks, as you show in your film. And that just, it outrages me, the daily thing, the papers please, the house demolitions, the blockade on Gaza, restricting food, the military occupation, and then, of course, the settlements, which I don't think Americans are aware of, but there are Jewish-only cities where Palestinians are not allowed to buy a house there, not allowed to even walk in there, completely racially segregated, squatting on territory that was taken by force by the military, and then a lot of them have an apartheid wall wrapped around them, which is not on Israel's border. It's inside the West Bank, so it annexed even more land. These kind of basic facts are not told in the story. It just starts with terrorist attack, Israel defending itself, omitting the entire occupation and the kind of daily abuse that Palestinians go through. What are some of the abuses that Palestinians go through on a day-to-day basis, dealing with, you know, just going to work, school, what have you?
On one trip, we just started zeroing the odometer at every checkpoint just to see how close they were. And there were areas where we couldn't get 2.3 kilometers, so under 2 miles at a checkpoint. And we could be an hour at each checkpoint. I mean, really, they're called checkpoints. You can call them roadblocks, but really what they are is they're vampiric devices that if I need to go 10 miles, 5 hours of my life could just be sucked out of me to get from point A to point B, because I would have to sit at these checkpoints. And these aren't like checkpoints on the border between Israel and the occupied territory. These are just harassment points where, and when you think about in the space of a month, how many hours a Palestinian spends at a checkpoint, at checkpoints within their life space. That it really is, it's sucking the life. Israel takes the lives of Palestinians every day, entire lives at checkpoints, let alone when they kill people at checkpoints. There's a woman in the film from Christian Peacemaker Teams. She's a Mennonite woman, but I think she really summed it up perfectly. She said that if Americans were treated like this, we'd blow up the planet. So I am amazed at the restraint that Palestinians have shown. The thing is that the reason that Americans envision this conflict as a victim, settler colonialist victim, and indigenous bad guy is because of the way it's reported. So, for instance, if you know, Alison Weir's organization, If Americans Knew, did a study of the amount of copy that the murder of Palestinian children gets in the U.S. press relative to the amount of copy that the murder of a Israeli child gets. And it's just incredibly disproportionate. So we're fed a bill of goods constantly from our media, whether it's in print, on television, or on the radio here in the United States. The web is really, I think it's the road to human liberation.
Well, there was three Israelis who they said were kidnapped. One of them was an adult and a soldier, so I'd say captured, not kidnapped. But three Israelis got murdered in the West Bank, and so Gaza got invaded. And that was on every news channel, 24/7, these three Israelis. The party that got blamed was not even involved in the kidnapping, and then Gaza got collectively punished. That year, 72 Palestinians had been killed by Israelis up to, I think it was October or whatever it was when that happened. And none of that got reporting. They even burned a baby, and churches were set on fire. The miracle church where Jesus had the fish and the bread was burned. You would think that would get some press. Nothing that would make Israel in a negative light is ever shown in the American media. Now, I understand how Congress is so beholden to AIPAC and the lobby because that's the money. But why is the media so pro-colonialism in modern times?
Well, I think that my own experience is a pretty good, what drove me to this topic in the first place was the question of why would the U.S. press report an atrocity like an airstrike on a refugee camp with such delicate language? And I think the fact of the matter is it's intimidation that when people do actually like speak facts on this issue, they have a high likelihood of repercussions, professional repercussions. So they know. I mean, most people aren't going to put their bread and butter in play on principle, unfortunately. But I think that's it, that it's just a question of intimidation. That, in fact, Jon Stewart did a funny little thing on the Daily Show before he left where, if he said the word Israel, then a bunch of people would jump up on one side of him and scream at him. If he said the word Palestine, people would jump up on the other side of him and scream at him. And so he says, well, okay, Jess, I just won't say those words. And which is a really pussy move, if you don't mind me saying so.
Well, in doing the skit, he is saying those words, though. So,
yeah, right.
There's the comedian. He was the commencement speaker at my graduation at William & Mary. I was the president of the first Palestinian organization. We called it RIP, Reality in Israel and Palestine, co-president with Dahlia. And we screened your film, People and the Land. And in the audience, Hillel and all the rest of them were there. And the kind of questions we got at the Q&A were so ridiculous. And I realized, wow, we're dealing with a really uneducated public on this issue. Because, yes, if you read the media, they don't even say settlements. It's a Jewish neighborhood or something. That no context, no history at all. And then in Hollywood, of course, Arabs are just blowing up planes or throwing grenades or something. And I think part of it may also be from the narrative of World War II, because in that situation, Jews were victims, definitely. And so they can't be the aggressor now. They have victim status for infinity or something. But it just isn't the case. They definitely are abusing Palestinians. And I would recommend people to get people in the land as well. It's one of the first films to really show like settlements in detail.
People in the Land is available on Vimeo for free, so
there you go.
It's easy to get. I just finally just liberated that film, and Native Sons, Palestinians in Exile is also available for free on Vimeo. So they're easy to get, and you know, that's one of the things I love about this century is that it's so much easier to get information about anything. You know, if I want to know how to grow potatoes, I can find it out in 20 seconds. If I want to know why the Middle East is on fire, I can learn that pretty easily too.
We had a woman from Oasis for Peace. It's a Christian organization, and they have high schools where it's 25% Jewish, 25% Muslim, and 50% Christian. And she's doing her talk, and people in the audience were like, wait a minute, you mean high schools are segregated? Yes, they are. That wasn't even known. So a lot of us in the know have to really go back and start with the basic facts. And I had people at the conference, for example, from Korea and Australia and Japan, who aren't really that invested in it, don't really know the history. And they would hear people, you know, yelling slogans and things like at the rally the day after, but didn't know why. Why are they so angry? What's going on? And so these kind of films need to be said over and over again, starting with the basics, because I think the majority of Americans are not immoral monsters. They just don't know. And they're getting a very biased media narrative, the same media narrative that said babies on incubators, weapons of mass destruction, Assad's gassing his own people before even investigating to see if it's true or not. I assume it's not only what you said about harassment, if you bring up the words, but whatever is in the profit interests for our military-industrial complex seems to be promoted regardless.
Oh, yeah, I think that's true, that the longer the Middle East broils, the more arms get sold. But, you know, I think that the reason that so few Americans are hip to what's happening over there is because they're not allowed to. I mean, our press is so careful about exactly what gets through their filters regarding what's happening in the Middle East. But I think, you know, that the thing is that it's not like we don't have a dog in this fight. I mean, like every single American, we do have a dog in this fight, and it's called our taxes. That the state of Israel has a population a third the size of metropolitan New York City. And it gets a third of all of the foreign aid that we give to the entire planet. So we are like, American taxpayers are like sled dogs in bondage.
It's about $11 million a day.
Right. We're just dragging this war wagon along behind us. You know, when we go to work in the morning, part of our job is funding the perpetuation of this conflict. And so I think it's really important for Americans to know this, not because it's an interesting set of facts about what's happening in the world, but that every single American is complicit in the crimes against humanity that Israel is executing.
There was a Jewish rabbi who said, in a democracy, not everybody's guilty, but everybody's responsible.
Yes.
And you were responsible. We're sending 11 million and change a day, 38 billion over the next 10 years. And that's just the direct aid. That does not include, from the Defense Department budget, that doesn't include lots of other aid that's not in that number. And Grant Smith has some graphs to give you the real numbers, which are even higher than that. So we have a lot of dogs in the fight financially. I call that type of taxation part-time slavery, because they're taxing a lot of people 33% or more if you're a business. That's a third of your income. That means for every 3 years you work, one of them you work for free. That's slavery, part-time slavery. And it goes to pay for things like, you know, Lockheed Martin's F-35, $1.5 trillion. And the theater of war is the Middle East. And the great agitator is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That is the crux of the issue. It's Israeli partisans that drug us to war in Iraq both times. Oded Yanan wrote the plan for Syria. So these things didn't just happen suddenly. Even the September 11 attacks, what they cited as reasons, as motivations to do that, was the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Very little press on that.
You know, on September 13th, Osama bin Laden said that America will not know peace until Palestinians know peace. I mean, this isn't some sidebar issue that Americans don't need to pay attention to. I mean, this could be your life if you're an American. This is a critical issue on this planet. And it makes, you know, and the thing is that it makes every statement that the United States makes, our government makes, about, you know, respecting human rights and freedom and democracy, all of that is, it just, they make us look like fools around the planet, because the media in other places doesn't keep the lid on Palestine. People all over this planet know what's going on there, and know a lot more about it than we do, and we have, and we're in this up to our necks.
Japan gave the West Bank $100 million, and the very same day, two Japanese citizens had their heads cut off by ISIS. They've been captured for over a month, but they chose the day that Palestine got $100 million from Japan to put it on TV and behead these people. And you look at Israel acting like Al-Qaeda's Air Force. They've exclusively only attacked Assad in Syria. And nothing happens. They can treat al-Nusra fighters in their hospitals, and you would think, wow, doesn't America hate al-Qaeda? Isn't that who attacked on 9/11? Why are we helping them in Libya and Syria, and why are we allowing the Israeli Zionists allied with these Wahhabi groups? Aren't they supposed to be enemies? Don't they just hate us for our freedom? What happened to that narrative? It's starting to fall apart. Do you think it's getting a little bit better? Because for the first time, at least we had a UN resolution that wasn't vetoed. The U.S. didn't vote for it either. But by abstaining, they finally allowed it to pass. I think they've blocked over 140-some resolutions. And you have to also add all the resolutions that they don't even bother with because they know the U.S. is just going to say no. Do you think it's changing? Was that a signal or just a rare event to go against the settlements?
Well, I think, you know, I think that there are so many egregious violations of Palestinian human rights and international law that that was a blip on the radar. But I think you can probably blame the fact that it happened at all on the consciousness raising that's happening because of things like YouTube and social media, that what we saw, the realities that we saw, the last great butchery of Gaza, that this technology has now made it possible for people to get around this cloistered American media, this sort of like bunkered American media when it comes to this topic. And I think that that's, in the long run, it's, you know, information is the power that's going to change this. And I think that the internet is really where that power is going to come from.
Jon Snow from BBC, and Americans could see that because they could watch it on YouTube, had a debate about it. He said, I went down there. I saw the hospitals you're talking about. And yeah, it is falling apart. The media monopoly is coming undone. And I think key within that social media is documentaries like what you're making and podcasts. I think movies are what at least gets your foot in the door before people start reading about it. You need videos. Just being practical here, I think that's the most pragmatic thing to do, is share these videos and buy these videos so that producers can make more of them.
Yeah, I think that's a critical thing. And I think, in terms of the things that people can do, you know, informing themselves is just critical. Meet some Palestinians and talk to them. I mean, if you don't get this issue, talk to the people. I mean, like, if I wanted to know about slavery, I would really want to talk to a slave. I wouldn't want to talk to a slave owner. And that seems to me the way that the American media treats this is that if they want to know something about what's happening in Palestine, they get somebody who's a big Israel supporter on to explain it, to Zio-splain it to Americans. You know, you had touched on the UN, and I think that's a really critical issue that Americans need to be paying attention to as well, because, okay, the money is one thing. The money enables. But what really enables Israel to continue these war crimes is that veto in the United Nations. Mm-hmm. That the international community has tried over and over and over to curb this dog, but the United States keeps on cutting that leash.
There have been unanimous votes where the entire world votes one way, and the U.S. says no. Like, 140-1.
In Micronesia or some other island. Into voting along with us, but it's the money, which is just incredible. It's the veto in the UN, and then of course it's the very best weapons that we have that we transmit on to Israel. I mean, we don't give anybody else or sell anybody else the kind of weapons that we sell to Israel. And the thing is, we're not the only ones in this game. I mean, Germany has sold Israel nuclear launch platforms. They've sold them submarines that are capable of serving as nuclear launch platforms.
Oh, but they don't have nuclear weapons. They said they don't.
Right. They didn't say they don't. They just said, I don't want to talk about it.
the stupidity of that is like the One China policy. Like, people don't want to acknowledge that Taiwan is there, has its own laws, its own government, its own currency. It's a different country, but you're not allowed to say that. And something that could only happen in government, because any person would say, yeah, they have nuclear. Mordecai Vanunu took pictures of the warheads. Like, they have nuclear weapons. Oh, no, we don't admit that as a policy. Like, well, you can't just policy away the truth. But that's what they do.
Yeah, it is. If it wasn't all rooted in terrible war crimes, it would be hilarious. You know, sometimes I don't know whether to laugh or cry, because it's ludicrous. It's ludicrous the way that this situation is messaged to the very people who are responsible for it. I mean, you know, people talk about the Israeli occupation. There really isn't an Israeli occupation. There's an American occupation done with Israeli bodies. Mm-hmm. But none of that would be possible if the United States just said, well, wait a minute, what about international law? Or what about UN Security Council resolutions? I mean, if a UN Security Council resolution is enough to destroy Iraq for occupying Kuwait, then why isn't resolution 242 enough to get the entire planet motivated to end the
abuses?
Well,
even with Iraq, UN Resolution 1441 wasn't even being violated, and they still got destroyed because they didn't have WMDs. I know a country that does, Israel. They're the ones with nuclear weapons that aren't inspected. That's where that goes all over the black market with this stuff. Of course, Netanyahu was personally involved with smuggling Krychon triggers through Helite Trading Company. I mean, and he's just a prime minister, no big deal. He's finally being investigated, but yeah, the UN is important. And when you mention weapons, it's not only that, it's also information. As Snowden revealed, all of our NSA information goes to Israel, all of it. So they have access to everything the NSA has, which is amazing. So they used to spy on it through Amdocs and Converse, and now they give it to them. It's unreal, but it's not really an Israeli occupation. I like how you said that. It's an extremist, like the U.S. always backs extremists. It could be Zionists in Israel. It could be Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. It could be whatever, you know, the MEK in Baluchistan. Wherever it is, We're going to back them. Jandala, Ara al-Sham in Syria. These nuts get U.S. political support and money because, with game theory, you know, if you put the nuts in charge, you're going to have conflicts, and that's cash for our system. There's no risk for the U.S. So that's the motivation, I think, that's going on. Was there anything when you were filming Two Blue Lines that you've been to Palestine many times? Did you see an improvement from, you know, from the 80s to the last time you were there, or are things getting worse?
No, every time I go. Every time I go, it's worse. And, you know, the thing is that these are, you know, you don't make films in a sort of non-human vacuum. I couldn't do any of that work without the help of many Palestinian people. And those people, I've known them since the mid-80s. And they had little toddlers then. And now those toddlers have children of their own who were born under the Israeli boot, and their lives are so much more constricted. They're just living in this vice that's closing on them constantly. The quality of life of Palestinian human beings who are living under Israeli rule has just deteriorated constantly and exponentially over the years that I've been going there. It's really, It's a nightmare. I mean, it's an awful thing to witness, because these are people who have become my friends and have protected me in my life at times when I really needed some protecting, because you know, the Israeli armed forces are.
They're the most moral army in the world, don't you know? They're the only democracy, and the most they.
Yeah. You know, I mean, really, it's when you kind of aggregate the war crimes that this outfit has committed, it really, it's disgusting. I mean, it's really a disgusting abuse of humanity. You know, Desmond Tutu said that it was worse than apartheid, and you're damn right, it's worse than apartheid, because apartheid. Yes, it was segregationist and it was exploitive. It used African people like they were hewers of wood and drawers of water for the white people. But this thing that's going on in Palestine is about liquidating the physical and cultural presence of the indigenous people. And it's doing it by essentially torturing them out of existence. To get them to go away, because it's better press if they just finally throw up their hands and go away, or if you know you don't have to kill one every day, you just this constant sort of treadmill of violence that's applied to Palestinians. It really is
it's like the reservation system in the U.S.
That's a really good question, Ryan, because it's not like this is some steady state that Palestinians are enduring, that this is a constant deterioration in their quality of life. I mean, dig this. Like, the children of my Palestinian friends who have had children now, like, they haven't been to the beach. The only way that they could go to the beach since I've known them was to leave Palestine. Okay, they live like 20 miles from the Mediterranean, but they would have to go out of Palestine via Jordan and then fly from there to Europe so they could actually take their kids to the beach. That's like, it's so absurd. Those are the sort of facts of Palestinian life, that absurdity and just the rankest sort of abuse, that's their daily bread.
Well, if you go to the beach in Gaza and you play soccer, you might get blown up. And if you're a journalist that actually reports that story, you'll be removed from your position and replaced by someone that won't report those things. And that's not sarcasm. That actually happened. Some of those toddlers that...
NBC, the fabulous NBC, that font of knowledge, removed a journalist for actually reporting what he witnessed with his own eyes.
Yeah, they were hit with mortar rounds, and then it's disgusting. Some of the kids that have been growing up there, I guess the grandkids of the people you first met in the 80s, have known nothing but war. I interviewed a 16-year-old Palestinian painter in Gaza. She's 17 now. And from her perspective, she's already gone through three major conflicts. Her neighbors were hit with artillery or something. Her neighbors are dead. It could have been her house. The psychology, this girl speaks perfect English, wants to get out of Gaza as soon as possible because they make it unlivable. And they know they can't return. And they have pride in their land and everything, but it's also their one life they'll ever have. And they want to flee. And that's the systematic, the new kind of genocide that you can kind of get away with in modern times because you can't just go in and murder everybody all in one day. The international community wouldn't put up with it. But they can put a blockade, they can demolish homes, they can confiscate property, they can throw people in jail without a trial, or though some kangaroo court military trial. This is the kind of disgusting daily life that Palestinians have to endure. But what can we do best to help them?
Well, that, of course, is the $38 billion question. What then must we do? And I think that there are three or four things that we could do. First, inform yourself. Read, watch films, get thee to Palestine. I really recommend that people just, it doesn't cost that much to go, but I think that once you bear witness yourself, it's going to be very hard for anybody to call you a liar again. BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, in your own life.
And that's not just for universities, that's for churches and other groups as well.
Well, and for every single individual, don't buy Israeli products and don't support corporations that support apartheid. And the other thing is to, and it's really easy to be cynical about politics. It's easy to go, our media cultivates a sense of powerlessness in Americans. It's like that's their job,
right?
Is to tell us that we can't change things. Yeah, right, exactly. And so I say engage politically. Bernie says run for office. If you can talk that smooth, run for office. But if you're not going to run for office, participate in the process. Contact your congressmen and your senators. Go and meet with them when they're in town, or if you happen to be showing the kids Washington D.C., go and see them and tell them you don't want this to go on. That they will, sooner or later, if enough people will actually engage democracy, we can make it a democracy. But the moment that you start thinking that you're powerless, you have made yourself powerless.
You forfeit. I mean, it's better to fight and lose than to forfeit and lose. There is an Israeli running for the Knesset, a libertarian Israeli anti-colonialist guy running for the Knesset who's going to be on the show in about an hour. So it's not only the Americans, it's the Israelis too that can run for office and say, I don't want this. His big thing, because he says realistically, he's got to aim at some low-hanging fruit. He wants to be able to go to the marketplace and buy eggs and groceries from Arabs because right now they can't. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but that the more you have trade and relations with people, the less violence there's going to be. Trade is the route to peace.
Well, and also just, haggling over the price of eggs with people is the road to peace. When we engage with each other, we can see our mutual humanity. And you are correct that outside of every quote Arab town, Palestinian town and village, there are these great big red signs in Hebrew and English that say that Israelis are forbidden to enter here because it's so dangerous. It's like the Elmer Fudd signs. It's very, very dangerous. It's Waskowi Taoist. It's sad. The thing is, I know lots of Israelis who don't pay any attention to those signs. They go into Palestinian area. For instance, the Mahsoum Watch people, the people who monitor the behavior of the Israeli forces at checkpoints, they go into Palestinian areas constantly with cameras and just with their bodies, just to say to the soldiers at the checkpoints, would you behave like that in front of your mother? because the abuse is just so disgusting.
Well, that's what's happening when you say they go in there with their cameras, because you can just get like a USB and put it up on the internet, and that's it. Because they used to confiscate these. If you actually went to Israel, they just take your film, they take everything. Now you stick it on iCloud or whatever you want, you're done. And that, I think, is what's chipping away at it. But we really got to get out in front of this. And I can't express how much I agree with you about how the media has made people defeatist and cynical and say, ah. But you look at what AIPAC does. They are organized. They go right into the Capitol building. They lobby daily. I don't see that from the other side. They're out in the streets talking to each other. They're complaining on Facebook. But they're not doing the grown-up thing of picking up the phone, calling their congressman. And yes, it's not going to be an instant fix. And no, they're not going to listen to you. But you can't only do things that are easy and quick. We have got to learn from the effectiveness of the Israeli lobby. You don't have to agree with anything they do, but the method works. And I advocate doing that. BDS, I support. Films, I support. But ultimately, all this energy has to direct toward one thing: talking to our own government and getting these laws changed. Ending aid to Israel should be a mainstay goal.
Absolutely, of any progressive person, because what we give to Israel, you know, this clowny president guy we've got, he's talking about eliminating basically all of foreign aid except the foreign aid that goes to Israel. And now the thing is that if, you know, Vietnam, if we had dropped, you know, 180 million tons of rototillers and mosquito netting on Southeast Asia, not only would there be a whole millions more people alive now, but we would live in a better world. People wouldn't hate us. And so, you know, getting our foreign aid priorities right, like clean water for people, maintaining the HIV/AIDS programs around the planet, that there are so many ways that our money could help in huge ways. Small amounts of money could help people on this planet in huge ways to live better, healthier, more enjoyable lives.
I worked with a group that got wire strippers sent to Ghana. This is a long story. I'll skip over it. But we were butting heads because of all the e-waste. And there's all the old computers and TVs and everything are flooding the rivers. And they burn them to get the metals to sell because of the poverty and so on. And we couldn't get them to stop dumping waste there. But what was really cheap is just to send a lot of wire cutters so they don't have to burn them. They just pull the rubber off and get the copper. So if they're going to do it, you got to think pragmatically sometimes. It's not exactly what you wanted, but just do what's going to work, you know.
Right, yeah. You don't need a billion dollars to solve a lot of things on this planet to really improve the quality of human lives.
Now, lies and propaganda cost a lot of money. Telling the truth is cheap. I really appreciate your time today. I could talk to you forever about these kind of things, but I'm going to let you go. But one last question. Because I was promoting your film, Two Blue Lines. How can international audiences, I didn't have a problem buying it in Japan, but people from the UK, Australia, and some regimes like that are telling me that they're having a hard time getting it from Amazon. So is there another way?
Well, I'm trying to get something on this, what is it, Petroni?
Oh, Patreon, yeah.
Anyway, I'm working on that, and I've been in touch with Amazon too, because I think it's a. I don't know why they're pulling this.
Patreon will do it. I'll actually help you with that right after.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Outstanding. But yeah, I want this thing to be available to people around the world, and of course the other two are available on Vimeo for free. So.
Excellent. Well, I will put links to all of the above below, where you can buy Two Blue Lines and where you can watch Native Sons and People in the Land for free, which is great.
Thanks so much. Really a pleasure, Ryan.